Hi there. Greg Swan here, and I am making this video kind of sort of as a way of introducing myself to you. I don't think there's any huge value in having a personal relationship with the author of a book, but I know that other people do feel that way, and I don't want to seem to be withholding just because I'm not hugely forthcoming in this regard. So I'm here with my guitar because I'm with my guitar a lot lately, and it's very easy for me to talk with my guitar. If you can actually play the guitar, you know that I can't. And if you can't play the guitar, then it's plausible that what you're hearing sounds like music, but it's really just noise. I'll talk more about the guitar in a little while because it's interesting for me, but at the outset, I think it's important to establish that nothing that you hear in this video will consist of a song. I don't know how to play songs. I don't know any songs. I know a few songs and I play them really badly. So if I should happen to play something in this video or any other video that I make that happens to sound like a song, you can safely be assured that it isn't, because I don't know how to play songs. The only way that you would know for sure that I'm playing a song is if I'm playing something that sounds nothing at all like that song, and then you know for sure that that's what I'm doing. So the reason I'm doing this is to inoculate myself from the need to pay royalties for other people's songs, because I'm not playing other people's songs. I do play my own songs, and they suck, but I do this for me, not for you. So in any case, that's the introductory disclaimer. This is kind of a disclaimerist video anyway, because I want to cover four topics that I think are important that I may later do in a weblog post or a full-blown essay or something like that, but I just want to take them up briefly to deal with them. The number one issue that I want to deal with, the one that I think is most important with respect to selfadoration.com right now, and with respect to the book Man Alive, and with respect to the controversy that I hope to incite with the book Man Alive, is that I am an ordinary person. And that's the benefit for me of making this video, is that you get to see me in my full state of resplendence. I am a meatball. That's what I call it when I see guys like me out in the world. I am a meatball. I am a chunky little ball of dough. I am Fred Flintstone. There is absolutely nothing about me that is not ordinary, and I rebel against any notion to the contrary, because there's nothing that I know that you can't learn. There's nothing that I've done that you can't do, and it's absurd to say otherwise, and so I won't let you say otherwise. I won't be a part of that. The doctrine that is discussed in Man Alive in detail is something that anyone can learn. It's no different from algebra or history or music, for that matter. Anybody can learn it. Anybody can master it. All it takes is theory and practice. All you have to do is master the theory and put it to work, put it to work in your life. Usus est magister optimus, practice is the best teacher. And if you do that, then not only will you achieve the same results that I've achieved, but presumably, plausibly, you'll achieve better results, because probably you're smarter than me. And my take would be that everyone is smarter than me, or practically everyone is smarter than me. I don't want to be in a situation where people are saying, oh, well, I could never do that. You could do anything. You can do anything you want, anything you set your mind to. And you may not be the absolute best at everything, but like this. I mean, I'm playing the guitar as I'm talking, and I know I'm not the best. I'm very far from the best, but I'm good enough that I can compose speech while I'm strumming the guitar and accompany myself. This is exactly like driving and having a conversation on the telephone, or having a business meeting in the car while you're driving. How are you able to do that? It's because you know how to drive. And I know how to play the guitar just about as well as a 16-year-old, and what that means is stay the hell away from me. I will cause an accident, but I can do it. I can do it. It's automated behavior. This is habituated behavior, and you do this enough, practice is the best teacher. You do it enough, and suddenly you don't have to know it in your brain because you know it in your hands. And that really does mean you know it in your brain. You do, but your brain knows how to handle it without a whole lot of conscious oversight. 145 Blues. You've heard it a zillion times. So anyway, that's the point of this particular segment, and I'm, you know, running on at length. I don't mean to. There is nothing that is extraordinary about me. I resist, I resent, I rebel against that idea because all I am is ordinary. All I am is ordinary. And I guess the real difference between me and other people, if there is one, is that I didn't volunteer to mimic, ape, recite somebody else's dogma. I looked at the world with my own eyes and drew my own conclusions. And I've shared those conclusions with you. And once you learn them, it's not from me. This is, Jimmy Klein says it's science, and I agree with that. It's science. It's a discovery. It's not something that I created or invented. It's just something that I discovered. And I kept good records of my findings, and I shared them with you. And when you learn them, again, it's just the same as learning algebra. You don't owe anything to anybody for algebra. And there is no some grand genius of math who can learn some math that you could never learn. If anyone can learn it, if someone can learn it, anyone can learn it. And the same is true for the ideas of self-adoration that I talk about in the book and on selfadoration.com. And so, run with it. This is your great opportunity. You have an opportunity to learn something that no one in human history has ever talked about before. And I'm not bragging about this either because it's just dumb. I mean, it's really dumb. It's no different from, you know, discovering radium or something like that. It's something that was out there forever and nobody noticed before. That's all. That's all it is. And I want you to learn it. I do want you to learn it. I want you to do better in your life in every possible way. But you will not do better in your life if you aggrandize other people and if you thereby diminish yourself and insist because, oh, I'm not him, I can't be him. No, that's ridiculous. You don't need to be me. You need to be who you are, and you need to be the best you that you can be. And the way that you will go about that is by following the path that I've outlined. And God help us both, you'll discover new territory that I know nothing about, and I'll do better because of you. But this is all just math. That's all it is. It's just a practice that you learn, a praxis. A praxis is a practice that you get better at by practicing it. This is a practice that anyone can learn, and I encourage you to do it. All right, so the interesting thing about the guitar for me is that I'm 52 years old, I think. Kathleen's not here, so I can't ask her. But I'm 51 or 52 years old, and I have had guitars in my house since I was maybe 8 years old, very young. And they were always around, and they were always calling to me. And I never picked them up and I never played them. I had lessons here and lessons there and never practiced and never did anything with it. And even now, I mean, in my adult life, we've been buying guitars. I have 5 guitars right now. I used to have 6. I gave 1 away. We've been buying guitars for years and still they just sat around. Every once in a while I would pick them up and I would start to get kind of good and then I get distracted and have to start all over again. And not necessarily all over again, but certainly there are things that you have to do every day if you're going to play the guitar, and if you don't, it takes you a while to get back up to speed again. Well, I got tired of that. I just got tired of it. I learned Latin as an adult. I learned to write C as an adult. I learned to write computer software as an adult. I learned the Latin language as an adult. I've learned a whole lot of things as an adult, and I thought, this is stupid. Why am I putting this off? How much older do I have to get before I'm going to be able to play guitar? And so I just started playing, and I play almost every day. I have 6 days out of 7 anyway, and sometimes for hours at a time. If I have time, I will put in a lot of time on the guitar because I really like it, and I can play like I drive. I drive better. I hope I drive better than I play guitar, but I can do this. I can talk. I can read. I can watch idiot shows on television. Often I'll turn the volume down to nothing and just have it as a visual distraction, but I can sit and play the guitar forever, and often it's just that I'm playing with 1-4-5 chord progressions right here, and wide open E is the easiest thing you can do on the guitar. This is the secret to making a living as a street musician is the 1-4-5 blues. You can play it forever. And the audience will always buy it, and you can write songs like those artists on the street who do caricatures. You can write songs on the fly. You can write the blues on the fly. Somebody comes along and you say, okay, what's your name? I'm going to write a song for you. And it's just so dumb. I love it. I mean, this is really dumb, simple music, and all of the blues, much of jazz, all of rock and roll, a whole lot of country music, popular music, is based on this one dumbass progression, 1-4-5. You can play it a million different ways, a zillion different ways, and that's why there's so many songs written in it. But it's also really, really easy, and it's really easy for musicians to communicate with each other in music theory, all of it based around the 1-4 flat, 1-4-5 chord progression. The whole blues is written in 1-4-5, 1-4-5 in sevenths and things like that. And it's not complicated at all. I talk about music theory with Kathleen, and I can immediately turn her mind off. I can cause her eyes to glaze over in an instant by talking about music theory. But, you know, what I know is nothing. I know nothing. I know more and more every day because I practice every day, because I play a lot. I read a lot about music theory online and absorb maybe 10% of what I'm reading, but it's a little bit more every day. And the point of all this is you can learn anything you want. You can acquire any skill that you want, no matter where you are in life. If you bombed out in algebra in junior high school, and a whole lot of people did, and you have ever since then felt inadequate whenever the subject of math comes up, you can correct this deficiency. This is a correctable nuisance. All you have to do is study. And the same thing, a musical instrument, a foreign language, anything in the world that you want to learn. I wrote a guest post for freetheanimal.com, which is a weblog run by my friend Richard Nikolai, and I wrote a guest post at New Year's about making it a New Year's resolution to learn something difficult. A New Year's resolution to do something easy is not that impressive to me, and of course, people fail at that kind of stuff anyway. They set a, you know, weight loss goal or exercise goal or something like that, and you know, by January 7th, it's all over with. But if you resolve to learn something difficult and you set a plan for it and you put that plan in motion and you follow through, at the end of a year's time, your progress will be amazing. You will be amazed at how much you accomplished just by applying yourself. And so my answer is why not? My answer is a question. Why not? Why wouldn't you do this? There's nothing I really want to learn. There's nothing I want to know. That's bullshit. I don't believe it. I know there's something in you that has always burned at you, nagged at you, like my guitar sitting around staring at me for years on end. I know you have this too. And what are you waiting for? How much older do you have to get before you're gonna play the guitar or learn to speak Spanish or master mathematics, you know, even if it's just through calculus? But you can take yourself forever. You can get to Sheldon Cooperville in math. It's not going to be fast. It's not going to be easy. Nothing worth doing is easy, but you definitely can do it, and there's no reason that you shouldn't. All right, wipe the slate of that. I have lectured you enough. One of the things that I want to caution people about, and one of the things that you should be watching for in terms of the active self-defense of your mind, and that's a common theme, a recurring theme in Man Alive, is how to defend your mind from other people's bogus arguments, bad arguments, manipulative arguments, bad behavior in general. One of the things that I would caution you to watch for is something that I would call collective thinking. And I talked about this in discussions of mob behavior, where the mob will be at an inflection point, a point at which they need to make a decision in order to decide how to react as a group, but they don't know what to do. The situation is unprecedented. I mean, typically mobs run into the same situations over and over again, and they know what to do. They know how to react because they've done it before. But an unprecedented situation comes along, and they don't know what to do about it. And it is very common in that circumstance to watch people checking each other out. David Riesman called this phenomenon the lonely crowd. He wrote a book about it. But individuals watching each other, looking to each other to see what the feeling of the room is, try to get the consensus of the crowd. And it's all done in mother tongue, and it's all done very subtly. It's all done just with glances and smirks and snickers and uncomfortable laughter. It's all done in mother tongue. There is no father tongue component to this. If there is, it's probably a dodge. It's probably something that is being done to cover over this subterranean communication that's going on in mother tongue. If you watch the Voice, the TV show The Voice, it's really interesting to see. Three of the judges do this habitually. And during the auditions, it was much more obvious, I suppose, than it is in the show now. I haven't even watched it lately, but I watched it during the auditions, and it was just amazing to me to watch the three judges. I can't even remember the country star's name, but What's-Her-Face, the Ex-Masketeer, and CeeLo Green. Those three seemingly do not have any independent judgment. They look to each other to try to figure out what to do. Adam Levine, I guess his name, is the fourth judge, and he has his own mind. He thinks with his own mind. He sees with his own eyes. And so he doesn't do it. He's not looking to the other people to tell him what to think, and therefore he's often the first to react for someone who really does show a lot of talent because he's judging with his own mind. He's not waiting to find out if somebody else thinks. And the interesting thing about collective thinking is that if you're watching me to try to figure out what I think, and I'm watching you to try to figure out what you think, neither one of us is thinking. Neither one of us is thinking. We are looking for something between us, some nothing between us, to have the answer that neither one of us has in our own heads. Obviously, I don't do this. too much the contrary. And I don't really like being in group situations at all because I don't like groups and they don't like me. But if I am in a group situation and the group has to make a decision, you better believe I have an opinion. I can defend it in detail. And I'm not saying that you have to do that. I'm warning you, number one, to watch for this behavior in other people. And I think probably also I'm warning you to watch for it in you. Because other people can't know for you, no matter how much you might want them to. And frankly, they don't know anything anyway. If they're participating in a process like that, what they're doing is they're saying that they don't know anything, and plausibly they're saying they don't care. That they really don't care what the outcome is as long as it's acceptable to the group. They just want to fit in. This is alien to me, and I can watch it, see it, understand it, document it as I'm doing right here. I have no idea how to live that from the inside, and I don't want to. And my take is I don't want for you to either. And it's not my business to want for you. I do understand that. But I want to talk about it so that you can be aware of it, so that you can think about it, and so you can decide on your own what to do about it. Okay. I got one more idea, and then I'm going to finish. And this is something that I brought up again and again in the book, and I did not address it in a separate section, and it was really a matter of brevity that art is about cutting. When in doubt, leave it out. Everything that isn't really moving the argument down the field did not make it into that book. And, you know, it's 32,000 words. There's a limit to how much I can do in that kind of space. But this is an important idea. And of the things that we've talked about here, this is the one that is most likely to turn into an essay because it is fascinating to me. The idea is the idea of existentiality, the existential, what really happened. The existential is what really happened. And so I can say that a baseball and a baseball bat have the potential to turn into a home run if there's a ball player to swing the bat, if there's a pitcher to throw the ball, and if they connect in just exactly the right way. All of those things are potential. And so that just by itself is an exploration of the subjunctive. It is the subjunctive idea of a home run. How does a home run occur in the abstract? Well, how does a home run occur in reality? Crack. Smash. Wow, the crowd goes wild. All of these things really happen. And the difference between subjunctive or imaginary events and real events is a bright line distinction, that the subjunctive and the imaginary events can be interesting to consider, and they may inform us about existential reality, but what really happens is what really happens and nothing else. And so I bring up the idea of complete absence of villains in my experience of life. I just don't see villains anywhere. I see ordinary people screwing up. And people will immediately react, well, I've known sociopaths, I've known psychopaths, I've known malignant narcissists. I don't believe you. I think you probably had a prick boss who held you accountable and you didn't like it. And I know a little thing about prick bosses because I am one. But I don't think you really met somebody like that because they're extremely rare. And if you did and you survived, I want to see the scars. I want to see the wounds. Because when you run into a sociopath, your chances of surviving are very slim. And if you do survive, your wounds are going to be outrageous. They're going to be huge. They're going to be woo. I really don't want to see them. But what I'm saying to you is when someone says, my spouse is abusive to me, what you should say is, oh man, that's so awful. Can I see the hospital reports? Can I see the police reports? What you're listening to is an exaggeration. And when someone says, oh, my boss is a sociopath, well, this is an exaggeration. That's all it is. I mean, you know, it's not a diagnosis. And if your boss does not come to work with all kinds of really beautiful knives and guns and ropes and things like that, your boss is not a sociopath. He's just a prick. But the important thing about the existential is that that's the only thing you can observe. It's the only thing you can experience is existential reality. And so are there sociopaths in the world? I assume there are. I've never met one, but I'm told there are, and I believe it. Are there epileptics? I've met one in my life. There are epileptics. But they're outliers. And in the case of sociopaths or malignant narcissists or whatever, they're extreme outliers. These are people you're not going to meet in real life. Who are you going to meet in real life? Ordinary people. Like your spouse. Like your family. Like your kids. Like your friends. Like the people at work. That's who you meet. Who really exists in reality? Well, do the outliers exist? Yes, they do. There are black swans in the world. Do they matter? Almost not at all. If someone in your family has epilepsy or someone in your office has epilepsy, then you need to know what to do about epilepsy. But for the most part, you don't. Because epileptics are outliers. And that's not a criticism of them. It's just a recognition of their statistical rarity. And what matters in real life is the existential, and the existential is the statistically common. It is the norm. It is normal stuff, everyday stuff. And so if you insist there must be villains in the world, I'm going to command you to produce one. Show me this villain. Introduce me. I have 10 good questions for anybody that I meet. And if you give me 10 questions with a real villain, I will demonstrate that that person is really a villain, or much more likely, I will demonstrate that that person is just a normal person who has some bad habits that you object to. That's it. When I talk about academics and their ridiculous theories about human behavior, human nature, what I always want to do is carry it back to the existential. I say carry it back to the object. I want to carry it back to the real object. And so if somebody says, oh, well, our behavior is controlled by our genes, and there's really nothing we can do about it. If you're predisposed to be a rapist, you're going to be a rapist. And so when that academic says something like that, I want to talk to him about his daughter's first date. He's meeting his daughter's first date. She's upstairs getting dressed. Dad and the kid have a chance to get to know each other. This is Dad's opportunity to point out, if that kid cannot keep his pecker in his pocket, that Dad is going to mount it over the mantle. Right? That's what dads do in that circumstance. This is existential reality. This is what really happens. And if you are a pinhead who makes the argument that human behavior is determined by genes or behavior, by blood chemistry, by hormones, by your financial circumstances, any of these retarded arguments about determinism, I want to know what you say to that kid when he's going to take your daughter out. Do you say, well, son, I understand that you are who you are and you can't change your behavior, that you are baked in the cake, and it could well be that you will return my daughter in 17 pieces, but what the heck can I do? And I promise you that that asshole will not say that. This is not the way he behaves. This is not what he actually believes. And how do we know what people actually believe? Watch what they do. What you do is what you really believe. That if you read some doctrine and you say, oh, from now on, I'm going to be a vegan. People who follow through on veganism die young, and most people who claim to be vegans have a steak every once in a while, and if they didn't, they'd die. What you really do is what you are. What you really do is what you think. And if you or someone else is propounding some absurd doctrine, then what you need to do is you need to watch in reality to see what's really going on. What choices is this person actually making? And if their choices conflict with the doctrine, if they contradict the doctrine is false in the opinion of the person who's acting that way. That person does not believe what he claims to believe. And this is immensely useful in dealing with people because they'll show you who they are. They will be very forthcoming in showing you who they are, not in their words, but in their behavior. And so that's the issue of existentiality. I do think that at some point I will write this in essay form because it's really important and there are a whole lot of issues to be discovered in there. But I've been going on for about 25 minutes here and it's time for me to make my exit. So pirated that song. I didn't steal that song because I don't know whose song it is, but they can't make cowboy movies without that song. My name is Greg Swan. I wrote a book called Man Alive, A Survival Manual for the Human Mind, and the title is absolutely sincere if you want to protect your mind from all of the nonsense that's going on around you in the world. You need to read that book. You can find it at selfadoration.com, along with a whole bunch of other stuff. I love your mind. I mostly don't care with what you're doing with it, but I believe you can change that. I think that anyone can master anything, that any lapse or omission or defect that you observe in your behavior and your character can be corrected. All of this is a correctable nuisance. And I think that if you do that, you will achieve amazing things with your life, that you will achieve an idea that I call splendor, which is unlimited human joy. And frankly, one of the reasons that I'm making this video is to kind of show you what mine looks like. Bless you. Thank you so much for your time, for your attention. You have a great day.